Pete Best is going to be talking in the Last Lane in Grafton Street on March the 29th. That's in Dublin. And then on March the 27th, 2 days before that, it's in the Riverhouse Hotel in Wexford. And Pete Best is sitting in front of me now. And Pete, you're very welcome to the programme one more time.
Thank you again.
Okay, I'll get to that in a minute or two. But Pete, like, you know, when people talk about Pete Best, or talk to you, is it okay that you stick with the 2 years, 60 to 62, and everything that happened afterwards? Like, in other words, about your time in the band?
No, I mean, people talk to me about that, but, you know, life's gone on since then.
Of course.
Maybe they're only interested in that particular segment, Dave.
Yeah.
But such a lot has transpired since then that it's equally as important. To me, anyway.
Well, of course it is. Yeah, my God. Okay, well, let's just take a look. I mean, like, in terms of just the very beginning, we're talking 79 years of age at the end of this year. That's November 24, 41, born in Madras. But you were brought up in Liverpool. Your dad died in World War II.
Yeah, yeah.
Your mum married Johnny Best in 44, etc. Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, the big thing is, like, if you get to the late 50s, we had the London coffee bars were happening, and things were happening in terms of bands playing and those kind of things too. Was your mother, do you think, when you look at it now, a bit of a visionary? In terms of what she wants to do.
Without saying. They broke the mold, Dave.
That's what I mean.
I think it was a life in India, you know, because of the military life, the freedom they had, you know, freedom thinking. They were very forward thinking, you know. They wanted to enjoy themselves all the time. She brought that to England and brought it to Liverpool. And, of course, when we acquired the house, you know, Heyman's Green, which, again, was an incredible story because all of a sudden... my younger brother comes along and turns around and says, Mo, we've got this, seen this wonderful house in Heyman's Green. And she went, I need it. Didn't tell us. And she went and pawned all the jewellery and put it on a horse, an outsider called Never Say Die, ridden by Lester Pigger, at 33-1 in the Derby. And it came in, it won. And she turned around, we were watching it. And at the end of it, she turned around and said, I've won my house. And we turned around and said, what do you mean by that? And she said, I pawned all my jewellery. She told us then. And we turned around and went, what would have happened if you'd lost? And she said, I never thought about that. But that was the calibre of the woman. And then all of a sudden, she watched the programme with the Two Eyes Coffee Club in London.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit like the catalyst for the London sound.
Of course.
And she turned around and said, I'm going to open a... We had Sellers in Heyman's Green. She turned around and said, we're going to open a coffee club in my house.
The Casper Coffee Club.
The Casper Coffee Club.
Yeah, exactly, right. So, I mean, your mum did that. And when you say, like, you know, the places in London did whatever, this place in Liverpool did it too, didn't it? It was the place.
Oh, it was the catalyst. It was the catalyst. I mean, the amazing thing about it was the Quarrymen, which later evolved to the Beatles...
Mm.
With the band which opened the club, 29th of August 1959. And it was John George Paul and Ken Brown, no drummer. I was in the audience that particular night, I watched it. And there was something, even at that stage, mercurial about them. And then I got a phone call from Paul about 12 months afterwards, turning around saying they had the offer to go to Germany. Cut a long story short, I ended up being a Beatle. And we went to Hamburg. That was
okay, that's 12 months later, you say. That'll be August 1960. And the TV star search and Johnny and the Moondogs and all the stories that people have read about. Now, you were in the Blackjacks, etc. And then the night before they go to Hamburg, or just beforehand, you get a call from Paul, will you come and be the drummer on the thing? And you were there for like 200 or 300 gigs, and you were there for 2 full years, etc. And the club manager wanted a 5-piece at the time, didn't he? And, like, you know, like, it was all okay. Like, whoever, like, Stu Sutcliffe was there, or was he at that time?
No, Stu was there first trip out, and second trip out for a short while,
right, and what was the name of the band when you were there for first? Was it the Silver Beatles?
No. They'd been called the Silver Beatles because they toured with one of Larry Parnes's acts and they called themselves the Silver Beatles then. But when I joined them and I'd auditioned for them and we were on our way out to Germany, John Lennon turned around and said, Silver Beatles, I don't like it anymore. And by the time we got to Germany, which was a couple of days later, we were the Beatles.
Mm.
So as far as I was concerned, I played as a Beatle.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. But like you were in the Beatles, and we're talking about Hamburg here, and Hamburg was a crazy place, gangsters and sex and money, and John would go on stage and say Heil Hitler, which really wasn't very cool necessarily.
It was, you know, typical Liverpool.
but like you're not in Liverpool, that's the point. And you went to like a club there to play, you were in the Indra, etc., and then you had to move to the Kaiser Keller, and there's all these kind of amazing stories that people know about Hamburg and the mad things that happened. And you played all the time, loads of gigs, minimum 7 a week, minimum.
Oh, God. It was incredible. We didn't know what we were coming into, to be quite honest, because when we got there, it was like the excitement of coming into Hamburg, playing a club. And then Bruno Koschmied, who was the manager, we asked him, he said, you know, how many nights are we playing? He said, 6-7 nights a week. That was fine. How many hours a night are we playing? 6-7 nights a week, Monday to Friday. Saturday, you play till 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was like, wow, but it's rock and roll. You know, get on with it.
Yeah.
But because of those long hours, Dave, I think we emanated from being this humble, mediocre band into being this pulsating, savage rock and roll band.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like it made men out of the boys, if you like.
And if you understand, yeah. That's
those kind of 24 months, absolutely huge. And return visits to Hamburg. Now, you were getting on well with everybody in the band, particularly with John. Mm-hmm. Was John the one you liked the most, probably?
Yeah, I liked all of them, but propping the bars up in Hamburg, you know, there's another side of John I saw, which was a very tender and loving side. And of course, the world emanated that many, many years afterwards. You know, but to me, at that early stage, you put those two components together, that was my man.
Well, that's true, but like, I mean, by the end of the 1960s, you know, John, his introduction to heroin from Yoko and all that kind of thing, the nastier side would have come out a bit more often. It was best to avoid John for a while, I would have thought.
Well, not at that stage. I can remember him being this, you know, yeah, he was sardonic. He was, you know, defence mechanism. He was insulting to people, but, you know, I'd seen the other side of him. It was like, fine, okay. Use that to keep your public off if you don't like them. But, you know, when you're with me, it's a different kind of kettle of fish. I think it surprised me a little bit afterwards, Dave, because I've heard many reports afterwards and listened to John's interviews where he slated me.
Yeah.
You know, he's absolutely torn me apart. And it was a little bit like, wow. You know, but it didn't change my opinion of him. You know, to me, he was still, as far as I was concerned, he was the Beatles.
Right. I mean, like, you don't have any resentment or you don't have hard feelings, but the way it was done was pretty not great, to put it bluntly. The majorly that John, Paul and George, and it was really nothing to do with Ringo, with all due respect, it was John, Paul and George could have been nicer about it in terms of you leaving the band, and they weren't.
True. Very, very true. I've never put the finger on Ringo for accepting the gig. Mm. A lot of people have sat around and said, you know, why did he? And it's like, look at it. Look at it from Ringo's point of view. He'd been with Rory Storm, which had been the number one band in Liverpool. The Beatles had come along, eclipsed them. He'd gone in the pecking order down from being number one drummer to way down in the ranks. And all of a sudden, John and Paul come along and go, Ringo, join the band.
But also, I mean, like, Paul had persuaded you to go to Hamburg. Paul was the one who got in touch with you. So these things happen. And, like, you know, he wanted you to do that and it happened fine, you know? Isn't that it? It was Paul who wanted you in the band.
Initially, you know, as I turn around to say, I don't know the logic behind it. I never will. There's been so many assumptions which you've, what's happened, you know.
Yeah.
Wasn't a good enough drummer, which has never held up water, was antisocial, hairstyle, you name it. They've been well chronicled, Dave.
Yeah.
And that's people making assumptions of it. Whatever their reason was for getting rid of me, I don't know.
You know, the funny thing is, you say, like, you know, antisocial or wasn't the right personality or whatever. Surely, like, the wrong personality might have been a good thing for the Beatles. If the other three were getting on in a certain kind of a way, like, people looked at you and it was written about, like, here's Pete Best, mean, moody and magnificent and all these kind of things is what they used to write about you. That's exactly what the Beatles might have needed, somebody different.
Well, yeah, they were. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was working. For 2 years, we would, you know, we went through doors that no one else could open. You know, we'd suddenly become this, you know, from this mediocre band to, you know, this prolific rock and roll band, which was kicking doors down. So, you know, we got a recording contract with the biggest, you know, record label in Germany, Polydor. We went on to BBC, you know, Epstein took us up. We got a recording contract with Parlophone. things were flying. You know, we were doing things which no other band from Liverpool had done. And then all of a sudden we get to 62.
Yeah.
Boom. You know, I'm hit with you're no longer a Beatle.
Okay, but this was like kind of the summer of 62 almost. You, like, I mean, famously the EMI sessions with George Martin and all the rest. One of the things about the George Martin session, did you ever feel there was something really happening here in terms of this band more than any other? Because of the fact that, like, you go in and you do four numbers. Now, John Lennon has said himself that he was freaking out about having to go to the studio and do these four numbers. And this was a deal they had now with EMI and all the rest. But three of those four numbers were P.S. I Love You, Ask Me Why, and Love Me Do. Three self-penned numbers. That was a bit unusual, was it?
Simply because of the fact we didn't like the material which they sent down. Epstein had basically turned around and told us we got a contract with Parlophone. George Martin had sent material down to us. We didn't like it. You know, it was like, we don't record that stuff. That's not us. So we were quite adamant about the fact that we wanted to record our own material. We tried the material, as you turn around and say, the three numbers. The original numbers, we tried it out on the audiences in Germany. We tried it out on the audiences in Liverpool. It worked. The kids loved it. Seemed logical we do it.
Yeah. You know?
The other one we did was Besame Mucho, which is a global number anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just souped it up, you know. We made a Beatles style.
And speaking of souping it up, again, would it be Paul who would have said towards the beginning of all these 200 gigs you played as a member of the Beatles, play it harder, play it faster, go for it. Like, he really wanted you to hit those drums hard. No, it wasn't?
No. No, it was a case that I was sitting at the back, and it was very much a case of, because you've got to remember, we weren't amped up in those days.
Yeah.
You know, we were very much, you know, what came out the sound, what we produced on stage. And I just felt that we needed to crank it up from the back. So I started developing a lot of tom-tom work, a lot of fills,
yeah,
a lot of bass drum work, just to compact the sound, make it this wall of sound.
And that's what happened.
That's what happened.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why when fame hit for the Beatles, even like what you had left there, your imprint was there. It had to be this.
Well, you know, the people of Liverpool called it the Atom Beat.
Right.
You know, so I was the creator of the Atom Beat,
right.
If you
well, that's
put
good
it
enough.
That way. Yeah.
When they say it was John, Paul and George sometimes and having a laugh and that you might have been a little bit more reticent to maybe take the speedier kind of stuff to keep them awake playing gigs. You didn't go for any of that kind of stuff at all. That you might have been outside of what the three of them were, which loads of people are in bands. It's not the end of the world. But, like, you know, were you and Paul deported for lighting a condom and sticking it on a guy's door and saying, right, okay, maybe we have left you in your club and we're going to another club. What's your problem?
Well,
your Honor.
It wasn't quite like that.
Was it
basically
not?
What it was, the dump we were staying at, which is the back of the Bambino,
yeah,
had no light. There was no electricity apart from one room.
Four bunk beds, was it?
Yeah, but Paul and I were in the, as we turned out, I said, the Black Holes of Calcutta, which were two concrete dungeons with a hole knocked out in the wall, and which we believed to be two beds by the side of one another. There was no light. We went back in to get our stuff because we defected to the Top 10 Club. Better money,
yeah,
you know, better club. And the only thing we had on us was condoms, so Paul and I stuck them on the wall, lit them, gave us enough light to basically pack whatever clothes we had left, and we disappeared back to the Top 10 Club. The next morning, we were woken up by the police, taken to Hamburg police station and charged with trying to burn the Bambino down. And as we've turned around and said, for God knows, nearly 60 years now, Dave, how the hell can you burn a concrete cinema down with a couple of condoms?
Okay, but I just gave that story. You said, no, it wasn't like that. That's exactly how it was. You chancer. You're trying to get out of it even still. Okay, so, like, just a few other things about all that kind of time, etc. Did you sing on anything? I mean, what about the Pinwheel Twist? What was that exactly?
Oh, God, it wasn't Pinwheel Twist.
Oh.
I mean, this is something which media pushed out. Someone misquoted it. The number I used to do was Peppermint Twist.
Peppermint Twist, yeah. Well, then what's the Pinwheel Twist?
Pinwheel Twist was a number Paul wrote.
Ah, right.
I
yeah,
used
okay.
to So my part of the act was the Pinwheel, the Peppermint Twist.
Yeah.
And as the show went on and became, you know, more and more animated, I used to get up on the front and dance the twist like Chubby Checker.
Right.
And Paul used to go behind and play drums. But it was the Peppermint Twist.
Do you know something? Like when you go and do a session, George Martin is there in the studio, and that he wanted what's known as a session drummer. Now, millions of bands were, well, I mean, any band that goes in, often session drummers are asked to go in just for the actual recording of the thing. It's like, we don't want the live guy. We want to do a different thing or get a different sound. It was common practice, basically. But when that happened, it seemed to be the chance for the Beatles to fire you. They seemed to take that up and go, John Paul George said, right, let's get rid of Pete. Why? Why do they want to get rid of you? I mean, I know there's talk about drumming, about not fitting in, about not, by the way, going with the hairstyles they were going to go with and wearing the leather jackets and all this. Again, it's good to have somebody different than the four.
I wish I could turn around and say, I know the answer to that, Dave, but you don't. Because when I was fired, and we found out from George Martin, he turned around and said, yes, I wanted to use session drummers simply because of the, I'm used to session drummers.
Yeah.
Economically wise, to know what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. But he stressed to them, don't change the physical lineup. What was going on in their minds prior to that? I don't know. So when, of course, the bombshell hit, you know, when Epstein fired me, I don't know the real reason behind it. The reason which was given, I wasn't a good enough drummer.
Yeah,
that's never held up water.
No, I think there's been a bit of admission down through the years that was a load of old nonsense anyway. Yeah, yeah. But like, you know, this is the same Brian Epstein, of course, who we all love and respect for what he did in terms of the manager of the Beatles and all the rest, who on the 24th of January 1962 actually signed to be the manager of the Beatles. And where did he sign it? Oh yeah, in your house.
Yeah.
Lots of things went on in your house in terms of the Beatles.
It was absolutely incredible when you think about it. It was, you know, the Casbah, Heyman's Green was the true birthplace of the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, they reformed again. As we've always turned around and said, if Maud never won, I'll never say dives, she'd never opened the Casbah, the Poor Men wouldn't have reformed, ifs, and it goes on. Because of the history, and because of, I think, Epstein felt safe in Heyman's Green, we felt safe and secure in Heyman's Green. It was where we started our careers.
Yeah.
It seemed appropriate we signed a contract there.
Love me do. Oh, love me do.
One thing you haven't mentioned about one of the reasons why you might have left the band is that people thought you were too good looking, and maybe Paul, well, laugh all you like, you know. Okay, well, like you're in your 70s now, so I'm not talking about now, even though you're looking pretty good. Point is that, like, that could easily be the case, could it? I mean, could Paul have in any way been jealous? And like, hold on, can I just say at the same time, the other Beatles member, the six, like the five and six, Stu, like he was the coolest in some ways because he was the art school student.
Yeah, if you look at the old photos of the Beatles, everyone has their own distinctive character, you know, and personality in it. The fact that I got more screams on stage one night, my counter argument to that is, if I got more screams one night, Paul would get more screams the other night.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't say that and walk off stage and go, oh, God almighty, you got more screams tonight. It was just like they were screaming for the band.
Yeah.
Who they screamed with individually, Dave, was their personal choice.
Yeah.
You know, girls are girls, guys are guys. You know, they like, I like him, I like him, I like him.
Yeah, and we're picking over silly detail in some ways in terms of just the fact that if the Beatles hadn't become as big as they have, we probably wouldn't be talking on any level about this kind of thing, because bands, everything that happened to you happened to other people 1,000 times
over. Of course it did. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you did 281 concerts with the Beatles, though, you know, and you did the first recording session as well. Well, you were in there doing all this kind of thing. And then the actual manager of the Beatles himself, he actually called you in and fired you within 2 years after you were a member of the band. What did he say to you?
Wasn't a lot, actually. I'd walked in and...
Brian Epstein was a good man, wasn't he?
Epstein was sound, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
Okay. He, afterwards, he tried to, you know, he threw a lifeline to me, which I'll talk about afterwards. But basically, at that time, I don't know what had gone on. When I walked into the office, I'd been into the office before with Brian Epstein because I'd handle the business side of things as regards bookings.
Yeah, you really were the manager before him, if you think about it, in terms of things getting done for the Beatles.
Yeah, promoters, fixing prices, bookings, taking bookings, yeah. So when Brian signed us, it was very much a case of, we had meetings, but it was very much picking my brains. You know, what's this promoter? What's the price?
Well, he had no kind of... any.
Well,
kind
he
of,
had no background.
No, he was a record shop seller of music, you know.
So I went in there thinking it was going to be okay, another brain-picking session. Walked in about 11 o'clock in the morning, and as soon as I walked into the office, I could tell it wasn't Brian's normal, cool, calm, placid self. very edgy, very agitated. And he talked around the subject for a while, and then he basically turned around and said, Pete, he said, I don't know how to turn around and tell you this, but he said, the boys want you out. And I suppose the key word was, it's already been arranged that Ringo will join the band on Saturday, which meant that something had been going on behind closed doors. That was the bombshell as far as I was concerned. I was scrabbling, sort of turning around saying, why? So the only thing I could think of was, what's the reason? And the reason that they give was they feel Ringo's a better drummer. That to me...
Yeah, well, everybody knows that's not the truth.
Didn't hold up.
Okay, but like, where were you thinking, oh, wait a minute now, this was like... Could you see that this band was going to do what exactly? At least become pretty famous in the UK, or at least last a year?
We could see it happening in the UK.
Yeah.
All of us could, because we just wanted that opportunity.
Yeah.
And Parlophone gave us that opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay, which Love Me Do went into the, you know, bottom end of the charts, but after that it opened the door.
Yeah.
What we'd realised was the fact, give us that opportunity, we're good enough, we're strong enough, we're bold enough to do it. Once we've got that opportunity, we're going to be number one dogs in England. You know, no Cliff Richards, no,
yeah,
you know, other people.
And Liverpool was behind you, the town of Liverpool, like in terms of the Mersey Beat, all the magazines, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because all of a sudden, you know, the onus had moved from London to Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, where before it had been a case of like nothing exists outside of London, all of a sudden, because of the Beatles breakthrough, you know, London was cascading down into Liverpool. They were looking at the bands. But apart from that, going back to your original question, it was very much a case of, yes, we did get to number one, which they eventually did. But I don't think at the right mind, no one envisaged them going on to become the icons of the music industry.
Obviously not, yeah.
That was just like, wow.
I mean, they didn't change music. They changed the culture. They changed, like, whatever.
They changed the 20s. Everything.
Yeah, they changed
style, everything.
Yeah,
else,
everything.
Else, yeah.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it wasn't necessarily a mean thing. These things happen. Just go find another band. Would you have said, okay, this is bad. I really wanted to stay with this crowd, the Beatles. I was getting on great for 2 years, but I'll go find another band. No?
Basically, when it happened, I had, you know, it was like I needed time to basically get my head together again, which I did. I stayed away from the public for about a couple of weeks, just stayed in the confines of my own house. I had offers pouring in from everywhere, Dave, from London, big bands, the other people joined me. I didn't, and I finally decided to join a band called Lee Curtis and the All Stars, which I'd heard good reports about. I sent spies out to watch them. And they came back and turned around and said, no, it's a band with a lot of potential. So when Joe Flannery came and approached me, I'd already made my mind up, yeah, I'm going with them.
Okay, but like, you know, when you were told in the office that that's it, you're dismissed, and like the guys want you out, which is Brian saying the other three did, and yet the other three never got in touch with you to say you're out, which is really like not very cool. I remember the last time you were here, on this very programme 35 years ago.
My goodness, mate.
Yeah, just the studio next door. You did say you never saw them really again. And you, like, I think you were standing somewhere once when they came off a stage somewhere. I don't know where it was exactly. You said you saw them. I can't remember exactly. But like Neil Aspinall, who was the road manager of the Beatles and that, and who was also was involved with your, was married to your mother?
No, he had an affair with her.
And he said, this is disgraceful. I mean, you go down to the Grapes pub on the same street as, Matthew Street, the cavern, and you go in for a pint in there, and he says he's going to resign. Now, what did you know about the Beatles then? Like, are you mad? Just because I've been sacked? Because you told him, don't even think of resigning. Don't even think of resigning from what? A band that's going to conquer the world? No,
not at that stage. But I mean, what they were doing, I mean, with the recording contract and the inner belief that they were going to do something big in Liverpool. Okay, he wasn't just going to be a normal road manager, which is ferrying bands around to local gigs.
Yeah.
You know, he was going to be, you know, with a number one band, playing tours, whatever else got involved, you know, I mean, from that particular stage. And that was the reason why I basically turned around to him and said, stay with it. You know,
right.
It was like, go with them, develop with them. As the world knows now, you know, it went far beyond that because Neil loved the bones of him, and I'm glad it happened. He became MD of Apple.
Yeah.
Right. And it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
I mean, like, you'd done the hard slog with all those gigs, you'd contract secured, you'd done your kind of Brian Epstein in terms of, like, you were the manager in some ways, and then you get the sack, and the guys hadn't got the whatever to look you in the face and say you're gone. In subsequent years, the one person you'd probably want to talk to, and he's still there, is Paul. Sit down, pint, nobody around. Now, Paul has to, like, did Paul get in touch with you when Anthology came out in 95?
No, this is, I don't know where this came from.
So he didn't?
No, the approach was made by Neil initially, and he turned around and said, Pete, Apple are interested. I'm the spokesman for Apple, right, because he was MD of Apple. He said, Apple are interested in doing the Anthology. They're interested in using some of the material which you're on, you know, some of your likenesses. How do you feel about it? I said, well, yeah, it sounds good. And he said, they're going to pay you for it. So I said, well, that sounds even better. Mm. But once it got to that stage, it went to legals. My solicitors sorted out with Apple's solicitors, and I ended up being on 7 tracks on Anthology One.
Yeah, Anthology being like looking back on the Beatles, the big collections of songs in the mid-90s. Yeah.
This story, which has emanated from Paul phone and me to turn around and say,
not true,
Anthology.
No. Hold on a second. What are you telling me here? Have you not talked to Paul at all?
I haven't talked to Paul.
Ever once? Never in touch?
Since
never
the,
to say, Anthology's coming out and I'm delighted to say you're going to get a few million out of this.
No, since the dismissal in 62, there's been no verbal contact with Paul whatsoever. Played the same 3 gigs as him, you know, because we support Bill Leakes and the All Stars. I came off stage, they were going on stage. Nothing was said.
Oh, that's the
and
situation.
There's never been any verbal dialogue between me and Paul since then. So where that's come from? Ask Paul.
So if he rang, pint, yeah?
Would no you problems.
Yeah,
I've always said that. I've got nothing to fear. As long as it's not going to be a case of we sit down, and I think that's what the media expects. Yeah. I'm going to turn around to Paul and go, okay, after 60-odd years, why the hell did you kick me out? Right? I'm far beyond that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be sitting down to talk with him about, you're a granddad, I'm a granddad. You've had 60 years in show business, I've had 60 years in show business. Let's swap stories.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice. Because, like, when they went on to be what they became to be, and you would not have been a spare cog in the whatever, you know, it would have been fine. It would have happened with you as well. Or would it? I mean, like, the whole Ringo thing, like, you know, they wanted Ringo, didn't they?
It was their choice.
But at the same time, you know, they got Ringo in and there were still more Beatles gigs to be done and Ringo couldn't leave the band he was already with. And so you did 3 gigs with the Beatles knowing that you were sacked.
No, I didn't.
Ah, you see, that's not true either, because I was just going to say, wait a minute, the 4 you went up on stage, they still said nothing. So
no,
tell me about,
no,
where am I, is that another myth?
No, oh my God, Dave, we
can
sit here and
let's
spell myths.
Let's write the book of Beatle myths and Pete Best.
Myths. Pete and Dave write the myths. No, what happened was, I was kicked out on a Wednesday. Ringo's joining the band on a Saturday. Okay, we had 2 gigs in between. Epstein turned around and said, will you cover them, Pete? I turned around and said, yeah. When I got back home in the solitude of my own house, I turned around and thought to myself, I can't face those guys again.
Yeah.
Right? But Epstein had already forewarned that. He'd seen about it, and he had Johnny Hutch from the Big Three on the same bill, standing by to replace me in case I didn't turn up. But the 3 gigs which I appeared with the Beatles were with Lee Curtis and the All Stars. They were the ones where we passed like ships in the night.
Ah, now I get it. Okay, right, okay. Because the whole thing being handled so very badly. I mean, with some of the crowd starting off saying, Pete forever, Ringo never. I mean, like that kind of thing. Like, how dare they get rid of Pete Best kind of thing. You know, Ringo can do fine and Rory Storm or whoever he's with right now. He doesn't need to be brought into the Beatles.
It was wonderful. It was very enlightening. It was very heartwarming that I had such, you know, fantastic support from the kids in Liverpool. But deep down inside, I knew that it wasn't going to change things. But it was wonderful to see the reaction from it.
Okay, let's go to about 5 or 6 years later, very quickly, but the Beatles' career, just in terms of albums, so short. Like, you know, from about 62 to about 69, it's really only about 6 or 7 years. Mm. And the White Album, which you said before, is probably your favourite album.
One of them, yeah.
Right, okay.
So diverse. So
yeah,
diverse.
I know. Around that time the White Album came out, were you packing loaves of bread in a factory?
Yeah, would have been, yeah.
That was your job then?
That was it.
Like, you know, you're married to Kathy, who was somebody you had met in Beatle times, right?
Yeah.
And still, like, that went right through, etc. You went and worked for the civil service for about 20 years as well. But is that what you were doing, working, stacking bread?
Yeah, yeah. When I quit show business, which was around about 67, 68, I went into, thought it'd be dead easy, I had the educational qualifications. filled the application forms in, went after the jobs, got to the jobs. Fine, Mr. Best, you're wonderful. Love your qualifications. What have you been doing for the last 8 years? I've been a rock drummer.
Yeah, right.
Oh, well, yes, thank you. We'll be in touch with you. Yeah. Right. So it was like that. And it went on and on and on. And in the end, I went to a bakery where they was doing manual work, and I turned around and said, have you got a job? Let me just get a job and I'll prove myself for 12 months that I have turned over a new leaf. I want to look after my family.
Yeah.
And they did. And I stacked bread and sliced bread, you know, for about 12 months. And then I went to the civil service, went to the employment office, and they turned around and gave me an offer of a job in the civil service. I said, fine. It was promotion. There was promotional channels available.
Yeah.
And I worked my way through from being a, you know, lowly clerical officer to managerial level.
And you've had a very happy life.
Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, I'm behind all the facade of show business, which I like being involved in show business again. I'm a big family man. Right. So my family is very dear to me.
Yeah.
Always has been.
And you've got grandkids.
Very much so, yeah.
Right, you know. Yeah. And by the way, you are, it's an audience with Pete Best. We are talking to Pete Best here, of course, on March 27th at the Riverhouse Hotel in Wexford, and at Lost Lane in Dublin on March the 29th. Just a few more bits and pieces. And like, I'll tell you, this book we're going to write, by the way, about myths of the Beatles.
Let's get to it.
Wait a minute, okay. Did you own a fruit and veg shop on Penny Lane?
No, I didn't.
But I presume you've heard that one, have you?
I have. Yeah. I've heard it down my, Dave, I was sitting one day and there was a Liverpool historian, right? And this is how it's gone beyond all realms, right? And I'm sitting there listening to Radio Merseyside, a local station, and I'm listening to it like that. And the historian goes, and they're talking about the Beatles and Penny Lane and this, that, and the other. And I was like, oh, yeah, Pete Best had a vegetable shop, a fruit and veg shop on Penny Lane. I was like, go on. And I know he had a fruit and veg shop on Penny Lane because I went in and asked the owner, and he turned around and said, oh, yes, I work for Pete Best, he's my owner, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just like, that's a Liverpool historian.
Right, okay, right. So that's how many there might be if it starts at the top like that.
Well, there you go.
Right, okay, that's a good answer. Okay, here's one, but this is true, isn't it? The cover of Sgt. Pepper's, John Lennon is wearing military medals. Did John ask your mother for a loan of those from your father from the Second World War?
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, and she had no problem giving it to them. That
it was my granddad. It was mother's father. Medals he wore was when he was in the Hussars, you know, the cavalry.
Yeah.
And Maud, in the early days, she talked to John and the rest of them about the times in India. She showed him the medals and John remembered it. So when Sergeant Pepper came along, he asked Maud, you know, would you please, you know, think about lending me the medals? And Mo said, yes. The conditioning factor was, you make sure they get back to me, sir.
Yeah.
Which he did.
Right. And they were in the Hello Goodbye colour video as well.
They were.
Yeah, right. He's wearing them in that, yeah. When you heard about John's murder in 1980, which, by the way, you're going to hear a lot more about this year, because John was 40 years on this earth and he'll be 40 years gone as well on December the 8th of 2020, or 2020. And just tell me, like, when you heard that, was it just like, where were you?
Dave, I was getting ready for work and my wife, Kathy, shouted up and she turned around and said, Pete, listen to this because of the time difference. And she turned around and I said, what was it? And she turned around and said, Pete, John's dead. And at that stage, it was just like John who was shouted down, you know, and she said, you better come down and listen to what's going on. And I came down and that's when I listened to the radio and they turned around and said that Lennon had been shot.
Mm.
But it's Idiot Chapman on the steps of the Dakota building and he was dead. And I was mortified. I just couldn't believe it. This was a kid I'd played rock and roll with, you know, I'd drunk with in Germany, been friends with. He'd risen to the stature of being, you know, one of the icons of the music industry, and some bloody idiot wasted him.
Yeah.
You know, it was absolutely, I couldn't believe it. And like the rest of the world, I was just like, wow, you know. Papers came after me, Dave, give me a story. And I just turned around and said, no.
Yeah.
I just want to stay away from it all, pay my respects to John, and I started it.
Well, I want to pay my respects to you, Pete, and thank you so much for dropping in again 35 years later. But just a couple of last things that I want to just get around. The anthology that came out of the Beatles stuff, and you had 7 tracks on it because it was all like going through the old Beatles stuff in 1995. Mm-hmm. Did you get the money? Did you make a good few, like a few million out of that?
It wasn't a few million, but right. What I made was, you know, quite consequential. It was the, I was already set up in life, Dave. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Don't think that,
sure.
that, you know, the what I got from the anthology was like, you know, set me up for life. I was set for life, but let's be quite honest. you know, when you get something which is, you know, coming royalties from the anthology, which I'll be quite honest, it's not the 8 million which people were spending, the 4 million. It was very comfortable.
Yeah.
Right? It's cemented my future for my family and future generations.
Yeah.
And that's all I can say thank you for.
Fantastic. And, like, just, should you have been on the cover? Should your picture have been there?
That's Klaus Voormann. That's the one.
Well, now, hold on, that's Klaus. But, I mean, Klaus only probably did a... I can't even remember. Like, he only did a cover he's probably told to do.
I don't know. I
Do a cover for the anthology, but leave Pete out of it. Do you think?
When the anthology came out, people turned around and said, oh, my God, they're still having a go at you. And I turned around and said, fine, if that's the way they feel. You know, Ringo's replacing me, I'm out.
Yeah.
But that many, many years afterwards, you know, in a way, I did my own anthology with Eamon's Green. So... the piece that was missing from that anthology, I put on my anthology.
Right. So okay. And just one last thing I want to say is this, which, like, people often say that he might be the unluckiest man. I mean, I interviewed Buzz Aldrin recently, and, like, he's always known as the second man on the moon, which is, like, better than anybody else except for one, you know, Neil Armstrong. So, like, people would say that you might be one of the most unlucky guys around. But do you think more people are much more concerned about this than you ever were or ever will be? Like, that's their problem.
No, I think, but they don't understand the fact is, you know, they're looking back at what happened 60-odd years ago. If they look at me and see me as a person now, you know, and come to the audience with shows, they'll see that, you know, there's more to life than just being a Beatle. You know, there's more to life than just being kicked out from the band.
You sound like George Harrison. He wanted out long before he went,
So it's very much a case of, like, you know, you believe what you want. As far as I'm concerned, you know, the way my life is portrayed, I'm still alive, I'm still healthy, God bless me, right? I'm happy, and long may it continue.
Wow, what an end line. I'm happy and long may it continue. It's an audience with Pete Best, these stories and much more, and he'll tell the truth about that fruit and veg shop on Penny Lane. I bet he does, all. March 27th in the Riverhouse Hotel in Wexford, Lost Lane in Dublin as well. An audience with Pete Best, not to be missed. Pete, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Dave. Been great after 35 years.